Welcome to Pree's Perspective, the Commercial Intelligence Brief, the definitive audio dispatch for commercial real estate executives, hospitality operators, and institutional investors. Produced by PRI Consulting and directed by veteran advisor Priyanshu Adathakar, this platform utilizes advanced AI audio synthesis to distill complex market data, underwritten deal frameworks, and global macroeconomic shifts into high-leverage insights for busy decision-makers. Time is equity. Let's look at the data.
Imagine underwriting an asset that mathematically guarantees your investors an 11% cash-on-cash return on day one.
Right.
The building is 85% occupied, the existing tenants are paying market rent, and you are acquiring the physical structure at an 80% discount to its actual replacement cost.
It looks flawless on paper.
In any normal macroeconomic environment, that framework looks like the holy grail of value investing. In the current multi-tenant office landscape, however, it is a localized capitalization failure waiting to trigger. By the end of this deep dive, you will understand the exact mathematical trap hidden inside suburban office valuations and the rigorous framework required to protect your capital from assets that consume cash rather than produce it.
Which is exactly what we are dissecting today.
We are executing a technical review of an exclusive market intelligence dispatch from Priyanshu, or Pri, Adathakar. Pri is a premier commercial real estate and hotel investment advisor, as well as a licensed realtor.
And while his expertise routinely dictates capital allocations in complex hospitality turnarounds and RevPAR optimization across the Midwest, this specific dispatch deconstructs the fatal illusion of the stabilized office building.
Okay, let's unpack this, because in real estate, surface-level numbers rarely tell the whole story.
The broader capital markets are currently mispricing risk on a massive scale. I mean, we are watching millions of dollars of private equity flow into assets based on a fundamental misunderstanding of operational friction.
It really is a massive blind spot.
To grasp the mechanics of this trap, we must first look at the psychological driver pushing capital into this sector, which is severe yield starvation. For the last 36 months, we have seen institutional and private syndicators attempt to deploy capital into multifamily apartments and industrial warehouses.
Safe harbors, essentially.
Exactly. But the influx of capital into those safe harbors compressed cap rates, the expected yield on the asset, down to the 3 or 4% range.
While simultaneously, the cost of debt climbed to 7 or 8%. That creates negative leverage. You are borrowing money at a higher rate than the asset is yielding.
And that mathematically bleeds the equity over time.
Right.
That structural reality forced capital to rotate. Sponsors and smaller syndicators must deploy capital to earn acquisition fees and satisfy their limited partners. They are effectively pushed out of the premium industrial and multifamily sectors.
So they scan the horizon for yield.
And their models highlight multi-tenant suburban office buildings.
Let's break down the core mechanics and technical hurdles of this asset. The specific data points Priyanshu Adathakar outlines in his report are staggering. These syndicators are finding older, Class B office buildings priced at roughly $80 per square foot.
Which is incredibly low.
If you were to buy the land, pour the concrete, raise the steel, and install the glass to build that exact structure today, the physical replacement cost would be north of $350 per square foot. They're stepping into a going-in cap rate of 10 to 11%, backed by a rent roll that shows 85% occupancy.
On a spreadsheet, the variance between that $80 acquisition cost and the $350 replacement cost looks like an impenetrable fortress protecting the principal investment.
I want to push back on the inherent danger of that spread, because it is crucial to articulate the defense of this strategy before we dismantle it.
Go ahead.
Think of this in terms of mechanical depreciation. If you find a fully loaded executive class Range Rover selling for the price of a used entry-level Honda Civic, the purchase price seems entirely insulated from downside risk.
Because the raw materials alone are worth more than the asking price.
Right, the engine block, the leather, the chassis. If I am acquiring an asset with a massive discount to physical replacement cost, doesn't that inherently floor the downside? I mean, how does the thesis of an automatic margin of safety break down here?
The thesis breaks down because you are valuing a static object rather than an operating entity.
Ah.
Buying a heavily depreciated Range Rover for the price of an economy car is a brilliant capital allocation at the exact moment of the transaction. The nominal price is exceptionally low.
But the maintenance is where it catches you.
The catastrophic failure occurs during the ongoing maintenance phase. When the pneumatic suspension inevitably fails, the mechanic does not charge you Honda Civic labor rates or parts costs. You are billed for luxury European SUV components.
So the acquisition basis is cheap, but the operational carrying costs remain extraordinarily high.
That fundamental miscalculation is trapping thousands of smaller buyers. They are confusing a stabilized rent roll with stable distributable cash flow. They look at that 85% occupancy rate and assume the building operates like a commercial airliner at cruising altitude, stable, smooth, and requiring minimal input.
Which is a dangerous assumption.
What's fascinating here is the total divergence between net operating income, or NOI, and actual terminal cash flow.
The underwriting models these syndicators use focus heavily on NOI. They take the gross rents collected from that 85% occupancy, subtract the fixed operating expenses like property taxes, insurance, and routine janitorial services, and the resulting number looks incredibly healthy.
It supports the debt service and projects a beautiful yield for the limited partners.
But wait, if the building is 85% occupied, aren't those tenants already paying the bills?
Mm-hmm.
Why does the landlord need massive cash reserves right away?
Because NOI is an accounting metric that fundamentally ignores the capital required to keep the machine running. Multi-tenant office buildings are not passive income engines. They are hyper-capital intensive environments subject to relentless physical and aesthetic decay.
So stabilization is an illusion.
Entirely. An airplane at cruising altitude only stays in the air because the engines are actively burning thousands of gallons of fuel per hour. In commercial real estate, that fuel is capital expenditure.
The assumption is that because the building is 85% occupied, the tenants are actively funding the operations and no external cash is required. But the office sector operates with an exceptionally high degree of transactional friction. Let's trace the causality of how this cash flow actually evaporates.
It begins with the physical asset itself.
Right. We're analyzing older, suburban, multi-tenant spaces. These are not state-of-the-art Class A towers with heavily capitalized institutional backing. These are assets suffering from terminal building obsolescence.
The physical infrastructure of a 1990s suburban office is fundamentally misaligned with the spatial demands of the modern workforce. The HVAC systems are inefficient. The floor plates are divided into dark, isolated cubicle farms.
They don't meet current standards.
Not at all. The common areas lack the premium amenities required to force employees back into the office. If the landlord does not aggressively deploy capital into mechanical upgrades, lobby modernizations, and exterior improvements, that 85% occupancy rate will plummet.
Because tenants possess absolute leverage in this market.
Precisely.
Yeah.
They will simply migrate to a competing building that has modernized its infrastructure.
That threat of vacancy forces the landlord to negotiate. Let's assume a 5,000 square foot tenant's lease is expiring, or a new tenant is looking at a vacant suite. The tenant refuses to operate in a legacy layout. They demand the drop ceilings be removed, the walls demolished for an open concept layout, modern glass partitions installed, and heavy IT infrastructure routed throughout the space.
Which triggers the first massive capital outlay.
Tenant improvements, or TIs. The tenant does not fund this build-out.
The landlord absorbs the cost via a TI allowance to secure the lease. In today's inflationary construction environment, a moderate renovation can easily demand $50 to $70 per square foot.
That adds up quickly.
On a 5,000 square foot suite, the landlord is contractually obligated to write a check for $250,000 or more just to make the space habitable to the tenant's specifications.
And the friction compounds immediately. The landlord rarely sources that tenant directly. They rely on the brokerage community. This introduces the second crippling expense, which is leasing commissions, or LCs.
The broker representing the tenant does not wait for the rent to be collected over the life of the lease. They demand their percentage of the total lease value up front.
So if the tenant signs a five-year lease at $30 a square foot, the total lease value is $750,000.
And the broker's commission, often ranging from 4 to 6%, equates to a roughly $37,500 cash payment due upon execution.
Here's where it gets really interesting. When you aggregate these non-discretionary capital outlays, the spreadsheet mathematics completely detach from reality. The landlord has just committed $250,000 in tenant improvements, and nearly $40,000 in leasing commissions.
That is almost $300,000 of liquid cash that must leave the owner's bank account before the new tenant has paid a single month of rent.
It's staggering. A single 5,000 square foot vacancy can instantly wipe out an entire year's distributions if the investor doesn't have liquid cash reserves.
That single transaction can entirely cannibalize the net cash flow generated by the remaining 85% of the occupied building for the entire fiscal year.
The NOI looks phenomenal on paper, but the actual cash account is drained to zero.
The limited partners, who were aggressively promised an 11% distribution, receive nothing. The yield vanished into the mechanical friction of the leasing cycle.
But here is where the underwriting actually gets weird. The proponents of this acquisition strategy are fully aware of TIs and LCs. They are sophisticated enough to know these costs exist.
Moving on to our next major pillar, how this exposure was entirely neutralized in the financial models of the aggressive buyers, or rather, how they attempted to neutralize it through a pricing strategy.
The counterargument heavily relies on that deeply discounted $80 per square foot basis. The thesis is that because their debt burden is so incredibly low compared to the institutional owners who bought at peak pricing, they hold a definitive pricing monopoly.
They can drop their asking rent to $18 per square foot, while the institutional Class A building down the street is forced to charge $35 just to service its massive debt load.
The theory dictates that this price delta will maintain maximum occupancy. They intend to simply poach cost-conscious tenants from heavier capitalized competitors, maintaining their stabilization without needing to offer massive TI packages because the rent is a bargain.
It sounds highly disruptive.
So what does this all mean for the execution of that strategy? It sounds plausible in a vacuum.
It fails upon contact with the temporal reality of commercial leases. The entire strategy hinges on the assumption that capital will be available when the cycle dictates it. As Pri points out in this week's perspective, there is a looming 12 to 24 month horizon.
Immaturity walls.
Yes. The rent rolls on these newly acquired assets will eventually face maturity walls. When those leases expire, the tenants will demand facility upgrades. The brokers will require their commissions to facilitate the renewals. The required capital outlays are unavoidable, regardless of the discounted rent.
Historically, a syndicator facing a $300,000 TI and LC burden would simply leverage the asset. They would approach their lender, present the executed five-year lease showing future guaranteed revenue, and draw down on a revolving line of credit to fund the construction and brokerage fees.
The fundamental breakdown in the current market is the total evaporation of that specific liquidity.
Regional banks.
Regional banks have historically functioned as the lifeblood of suburban commercial real estate. Today, their balance sheets are under intense regulatory scrutiny. They are overexposed to commercial debt, facing deposit flight, and terrified of mark-to-market valuations on office spaces.
So the credit window is closed.
They are uniformly declining requests for new tenant improvement credit lines.
The syndicator successfully secures the tenant, negotiates the lease, and preserves the occupancy, but cannot physically fund the glass partitions or pay the broker because the regional bank refuses to distribute the capital.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this dynamic triggers a highly specific macroeconomic event. The asset does not fail because of a macro-level rejection of office space. The tenant wants to be there. The local market supports the business.
The asset fails due to a localized capitalization failure.
The operational model is viable, but the balance sheet of the general partner is fatally undercapitalized.
The syndicators stretched their equity just to meet the acquisition price. They did not model a heavy, unfinanced capital expenditure reserve. When a bank says no, the landlord defaults on the lease obligation.
The tenant walks away. The occupancy drops.
The revenue falls below the debt service coverage ratio, and the asset spirals into distress.
This is exactly how Pry saw what the spreadsheets missed. The initial valuation models assumed continuous, friction-free liquidity from regional lenders. By utilizing Pry's boots-on-the-ground approach, observing the actual lending behavior and construction costs in the central Ohio and wider Midwest markets, the reality becomes stark.
The spreadsheets optimized for a theoretical cap rate while ignoring the absolute necessity of terminal liquidity.
Which establishes the definitive bottom line of this analysis.
Acquiring a stabilized, multi-tenant suburban office building at a steep discount to replacement cost is only a mathematically sound deployment of capital if the sponsor possesses the sovereign balance sheet to sustain it.
If the underwriting relies on the asset's internal cash flow or external regional bank debt, to fund the inevitable waves of tenant improvements, leasing commissions, and physical obsolescence, it is a catastrophic misallocation.
You are not acquiring a yielding asset. You are acquiring a heavily discounted, ticking financial liability.
The distinction between nominal price and the true cost of carry is the ultimate filter for sophisticated capital. Evaluating the structural integrity of these syndications requires an understanding of exactly who holds the liquidity when the capital calls inevitably fail.
Whether you are evaluating real estate, a business acquisition, or a complex joint venture, you have to rigorously underwrite the hidden carrying costs.
This raises an important question for institutional owners and private equity groups monitoring this space. As these thinly capitalized syndicators hit their maturity walls over the next 24 months, and regional banking liquidity remains frozen, who ultimately absorbs the capitulation of these assets? More critically, how can well-capitalized funds position themselves to extract the residual value when these localized capitalization failures force the assets back onto the market at literal pennies on the dollar?
That is the exact macroeconomic framework you must apply when evaluating any discounted asset class. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive. Execute your underwriting with precision, account for the structural friction, and we will see you in the next briefing.
You've got the perspective. Now it's time to drive the news forward. To ensure you never miss a market shift, tap subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen. If today's insights are going to impact your strategy, share this episode with a colleague or investment partner who needs to see the big picture. For actionable guides, newsletter subscriptions, and direct advisor consultation, head over to bearinvestors.com. Thank you for listening. We'll watch the market closely. Until next week.